Our second case for this morning is Rockies Express Pipeline versus 77.620 acres, more or less, number 111219. Mr. Mills?
May it please the Court, my name is Stephen Mills. I represent the owners, Bertels and Watts. Essentially, we're here on review of a motion in limine that was granted prohibiting the expert witness of the owner's valuation witness from testifying in a condemnation case. And also, we're here for review of the summary judgment that was entered simultaneously therewith, which prevented the owners from testifying themselves as to a value regarding just compensation. With respect to the issue of jurisdiction, it's the owner's position that Jessup essentially provides that once a stipulation to dismiss has been signed by the parties, that the trial court effectively loses jurisdiction. And that if that is so, then it would seem that the only thing that the magistrate's activity in the case subsequent to that would have been immaterial or managerial. All he essentially did was inform the clerk of the court that the parties had resolved the case and that the case should be formally closed by the clerk.
This is your Rule 71.1 stipulation, right?
Pardon me?
The stipulation that you entered pursuant to Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 71.1.
Yes, that would have been the parties preceding me that entered into it with Rockies Pipeline, I believe.
Right.
Yes, and I don't believe there was any jurisdiction retained in that stipulated agreement.
There was nothing else floating around as of the time that was done.
I don't believe so, Judge, although I wasn't privy to that agreement, but I'm confident reviewing it there was not.
One thing I'm not clear on, maybe you can clear it up. The issue in highest and best use of the property. It seems that most of this, if not all of it, is agricultural.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I'm confused because there are different sizes of parcels, but generally, isn't it highly speculative to imagine that there's going to be some sort of a commercial or residential development in this circumstance and then going on and trying to find comps that are applicable to those kinds of developments as opposed to the highest and best use being agricultural?
Well, Your Honor, we would say that with respect to that, the owners take the position that the court, whatever standard would be applied, okay, is met. I mean, the case cited and relied upon by the court in making its determination as to highest and best use was Crystal Lake. And in Crystal Lake, you essentially were dealing with a fairly substantial parcel of land that was a home. It was a slough and a pond suitable for muskrats.
But these are all factually based. I had the same question that Judge Mannion has. Had there been some foundation for the assumption that maybe this agricultural land in the somewhat foreseeable future was going to be rezoned for commercial or residential use, or that some developer had approached one of the owners or something. I mean, as it is, I think the district court was concerned that there was just nothing concrete there to think that this land was going to change.
Well, once again, I think the owners did testify that they had at least one of the owners testified that he had been approached and it didn't go anywhere. I mean, he's a farmer.
Right, but that's speculative, or insufficiently concrete. So, you know, when, how much, what would have been needed?
I think in our response to his motion for summary judgment, under Illinois law, we highlighted essentially eight factors, and it's cited in our reply brief or our brief, where we discuss those factors and the fact that the expert witness, along with the land engineer that was involved and hired by the expert, which the court does not mention, as well as that all opined that the locale was susceptible, that there was demand in the market for such kinds of development as was proposed here, commercial and or residential development. It's a one-off ramp located within 5 miles of the city of Springfield. And once again, when that's compared to Crystal Lake, and I think we do have to compare facts and circumstances.
We need first to look at the underlying facts of this case. What concrete evidence was put before the district court to think that it should include in the comps things that have already been subdivided, things that are used for commercial property. I'm looking at these things, and of his 10 examples, six of them were already subdivided, and one of them was commercial, and that's why the district court thought they really just the case had not been made that they were comps.
Well, with respect to that particular issue, the owners would argue that inadmissibility of comps speaks to the interplay between 701 and 703.
It does. It also speaks to whether the average value is reliable. If you have 10 pieces of property and you have to exclude the top seven in terms of value, your average is going to fall, right?
Well, does it concern the court that the appraiser that was left to value the case had to upgrade each of his comparables in order to arrive at his because he recognized the potential for development on the property?
I would say, again, evidence base is the whole key here. So if you had said, you know, there's a 10% chance that over the next 5 years somebody's going to move down 5 miles from Springfield, despite the fact, I mean, if you look at Google Earth, you know, you can see where this intersection is. It's very agricultural. It's you know, little bits of housing, and then you get down to this point.
Well,
I mean, something concrete. The district court, I don't think, had enough there to think that there was a reliable report being offered.
The test appears to be reasonably probable. And as Crystal Lake points out, that may never occur in order to meet the test of reasonable
probable. How did you meet the reasonably probable test? Let's take your test. What makes this reasonably probable?
Well, there's in the 60-page report tendered, both the land engineer opined that this land is susceptible. It is developable.
Okay, that's fine. It's suitable.
It's
by an existing
judge?
Intersection, but because it's by an intersection, there are lots of intersections on I-55 near Springfield.
And nearly all of them are developed, as a matter of fact, and that's in the record as well. Every intersection is developed. In fact, this very intersection contained commercially developed lots that had been rezoned to able to support a gas station. Now, the gas station wasn't running there.
How much of the owner's property carried a zoning classification that would have permitted further development beyond any agricultural?
None of the tracts that were being condemned, but the adjacent tract of the Birtles was already rezoned for a higher and better use, and right across the way, one of these tracts sits right next to an unincorporated subdivision, Your Honor. That's not some evidence of a demand on rezoning. We also supplemented our discovery by providing Rockies with evidence that the comparables that were used, two of them, by their expert, had already been rezoned to a higher and better use and obtained zoning or reclassification. And one of those comparables also included one that was used by Stollard. So we would maintain that is evidence.
But I want to focus on something here. If you were looking at comparables, there are lots of pipeline installments. Maybe it just doesn't exist, but when you're looking at the fair market value before and after, wouldn't it be a comparable to show a place where a pipeline did go through? And one where it didn't go through, something that is, where they would show that the one where the pipeline went through, has a reduced value.
As a matter of fact, Judge, I believe that Mr. Stollard's, one of the comparables that the judge deemed appropriate to use, did involve just such a track. And even though it was a substantially smaller track,
right,
he found that completely usable. But he said that has a pipeline going through it, will allow it to be used.
And that
is partially what he's basing his opinion on.
The other problem with that is that you got to have a willing buyer and a willing purchaser. When you have a comp.
Well, Your Honor, willing buyer and willing seller.
But in the case of, at least in Indiana, if you have a condemnation, you cannot use a sale when the purchaser has condemnation power.
We use no comparables, okay, and that's an issue. Where,
that creates a difficulty, in my opinion, as far as coming up with the comps that would work.
And how do we reconcile the ability with I guess my question is, we have cases in Illinois cited in the reply brief that says even though all 10 comparables were deemed inadmissible, in other words, unfit to hear by a jury because it would unduly complicate the jury, the expert was allowed to opine as to his opinion regarding that value. And in many of those cases cited in that reply brief, over and over again, a substantial number were done. After all, Mr. Stollard was left with 3 comparables when, in fact, the Rockies only had 4 to begin with.
But he said he couldn't do it. If they took any of them out of the 10, then it would have to change the whole equation.
No, he did not say that.
Well, who said that?
I respectfully would disagree with that, but a fair reading of what he said in his deposition was likely it would not. He said that at least 2 times. And then in response to continued questioning, he finally said, well, if you took it out of my calculation, it might. Okay? But taking it out of his calculation is a separate issue from taking it out of the court's calculation.
Well, but the fact is, though, he has to have some basis. Rule 702 itself requires expert testimony to be based on sufficient facts or data. And if he doesn't, and that's the judge's gatekeeper function. If he doesn't have enough, then the judge is supposed to exclude it. I mean, our court has excluded Nobel Prize-winning economists from testifying about economics.
I understand, Your Honor, and I would point the court to U.S. versus 14.38 acres with respect to that particular discussion in the context of what we're talking about here. Because there the court points out that we have this obligation to come up with just compensation guaranteed by the Constitution. And in essence, the court says the generally basis and sources of expert opinion affect the weight given rather than the admission of the opinion.
I understand the difference between weight and admissibility, I assure you. But the problem is 702 does establish a threshold even for admissibility. And if the expert comes in and says, I didn't look at anything, I just to take an extreme case, I know that's not Mr. Stollard, but to take an extreme case, if the expert comes in and says, oh, I think this land is worth, $1,000 an acre or some number, the court would undoubtedly say, you may be the best land appraiser in the world, but if you haven't studied this area of Illinois, I don't want to listen to what you have to say.
There's absolutely nothing in the record that would suggest that an expert would not have utilized these facts and data in order to arrive at an opinion, and that's what troubles the owners as well. It's not so much the lack of, what evidence is here? What evidence isn't here? There's no, am I to presume that Rockies, if their appraiser felt it was not data reasonably to be used by an expert, they would have not submitted an affidavit? I assure you they would have.
You're in your rebuttal time, sir.
I'm sorry. No. Thank you.
Up to you, but maybe you'll save a minute or two. Mr. Rolfe.
Yes, thank you, and may it please the court. My name's David Rolfe, and I represent Rockies Express Pipeline that's been referred to as REX throughout the pleadings and will be today.
So I have a question for you right away, which is this. I mean, it seems to me that it's an entirely sound methodology for someone to look at the value of an entire parcel before somebody puts a pipeline into it, and the value of the entire parcel, assuming the pipeline has now been built, take the difference and come up with what value has been lost on the assumption that once the pipeline's going through it, it's not as attractive, maybe even for agricultural use, but surely its marketability for further uses has been diminished somewhat. Do you have any problem with that proposition?
Yeah, the problem, I do, Your Honor, and the problem arises in the manner in which the jury would be instructed in this case.
No, but let's just stay with the formula first. So of course, eminent domain is all about fair market value.
Correct.
So it seems to me if you want to know what's the fair market value of the encumbrance that this easement is, it's not actually taking a certain amount of land, it's an encumbrance. a very rational way to do that would be to figure out what was the fair market value before the encumbrance and now what's the fair market value after the encumbrance. And that would give you a sign of what, for all I know, some encumbrances may enhance value, you know, or maybe the difference is very small or maybe the difference is big if the encumbrance, you know, is actually a road or something. It would be different from a, I guess this pipeline is going to be buried, right?
Yes, it is.
Right. So conceptually, now, I'm not talking about what evidence goes into the proof of fair market value before and fair market value after, but I'm just trying to figure out where is the problem in this case. And I don't think it's the formula so much as the support for either side of that formula.
Well, I would agree with Your Honor that the bigger problem with the case is the reliability opinion based on the support or, more importantly, the lack of support.
Because your expert also did a before and after comparison.
He did, but conceptually, and the cases say, took it to federal level, fair market value is you have the market value before encumbered and the market value after. And then the cases, and particularly Illinois law, but even some of the federal cases say, okay, that has to be determined and a jury decide that. And they decide that by saying, here's the easement taken. What is the diminution of value or what is the damage to the easement area that has been taken?
There would be
and
a temporary. Obviously, when the excavation's going on and all the construction, you can't farm that part of it.
Right. That's correct.
I assume after it's buried and everything else, maybe you can get back to farming
that,
over.
That is also
so the fair market value before and the fair market value after. During, yes, there is some loss of income and some other things, I guess, that is taken into consideration. But you have to separate the actual where the pipeline is. For instance, I think as Judge Wood implied earlier, you can't put a development on top of the pipeline, I assume. That may be a wrong assumption, but it would seem there is some, maybe not. Somebody has to say that. Is this off limits for future development on top of it, not farming, but go on and do something major? I don't know the answer to that.
Well, there are things you can do over a pipeline other than just farm, Your Honor.
I know you got to put roads over and things like that.
Roads,
I'm talking about
parking lots. I mean, you can't go underground, but
probable use of this land was to subdivide along the lines of other little towns that seem to be popping up south of Springfield. It's quite possible that the land that the easement, that the pipeline is under, the land affected by the easement, is not going to be subdivided. So they've either lost part of the land that's now perpetually going to have to be agricultural or green space, or, people don't want a big parking lot in their backyard either, probably. But you see, again, conceptually, this ought to amount to the same thing. If you value the part affected by the encumbrance before and after, and with the temporary, I think Judge Mann is right, there's a temporary diminution while things are happening that may be periodic. You may have to go in and service the pipeline from time to time. So there's that diminution. And there's the diminution in the part of the land that's not affected by the encumbrance, and that's going to be a before and after. So you'd be able to add those two numbers together and come up with just the generic before and after. Too. There's no reason why the sum should be different.
Well, the sum would be the same, but again, as you've just mentioned, you add the easement area to the damage to the remainder, and that's your total, and that's
right.
Going to be the before and after.
The sum of those totals. Absolutely, that ought to work.
That's the manner in which the jury is asked to calculate it. And conceptually, at the end of the day, it comes up with here's the value of this 20 acres before the pipeline, here's the value of the 20 acres after the pipeline.
Right, and then here's the value of the other 80 acres before and after. But I'm just saying, in general, I don't see anything wrong with the methodology itself that the plaintiffs used, owners used. It ought to wind up being the same number if you've used valid data.
I think the reason that the methodology is looked at and creates the judge ruled that it was a problem and not reliable under 702 is in this case it leads to the risk of a double recovery for the plaintiffs.
I don't see that at all. I mean, if the numbers are the correct numbers that you're plugging into the formula.
Here's the way it might lead to that. Rex's expert gave an opinion that said there was damage. Here's the damage to the easement taken. What, you know, $16,000 for this 1.77 acres through this. Stallard's opinion, the owner's opinion, then said, here's the damage to the easement and the remainder altogether. So he did not separate that out. Rex's expert also said there's no damage to the remainder. The jury's going to be asked to say, and if you look at the jury instruction, what is the amount of money to compensate the owner for the easement taken? That the only evidence is going to be Rex's expert. Says,
but
here's
that's what's happened to the property. The property now has, somebody else has a right to use that property,
right,
in a certain way.
And that's step one. The jury will say, here's that number. And then they'll say, well, did the owners offer a number? The owners did not offer that number. They just have a number for the whole.
Well,
and
the number
they call that damage to the remainder.
Okay.
So the jury is then say, is there damage to the remainder? If the jury were to find that there were, they would add that number, and now you've got a double recovery for the area that is the easement taken.
I'm not sure that's correct, actually. Whether the numbers that were being used are reliable numbers, a different point. But it seems to me, if it were done correctly, it really ought to amount to the same thing.
At the end of the day, conceptually, I agree with that, Your Honor. There's a value before pipelines there, and there's a value to the land after.
Using comparable values, though,
yeah.
What is a genuine comparable sale that can be brought in? Because this is the method that they're using.
That's
not
correct.
Using an income approach or something else. They're using the comparables. And I think, whatever they, here's a name for that, whatever it is, when you use comparables. But what would be a valid comparable? Do you have to have an example of an existing sale of a land with a pipeline through it, not by the purchase by the condemning power, but by a fair market sale? There's already a pipeline through it. Mm-hmm. Here's 40, 50 acres, and it was sold as a whole, which is one way you have to look at it, for another farm maybe. Is that the only kind of a valid comparable that would work here? Or did anybody ever use that?
Well, in fact, Rex's expert did take a look at sales in his report, sales with pipelines in them as compared to sales without over a number of years. And his conclusion on that was there was no recognizable pattern. So he used
no pattern, you say?
No recognizable pattern.
Some more valuable, some not.
Right. And so he said, recognizing that it is true that their property is going to be encumbered with a pipeline, they have lost something in the bundle of sticks. Okay. So he went and then chose comparable properties, comparable agricultural land in similar proximity, size, that type of thing, and said, here's what the fair market value is for agricultural land, and there is a reduced value for in the case of the first 40-acre parcel, the 1.77 acres taken. It was reduced by 25%, and that's how he used comparable in his estimated damage. But he did take a look at that, and in his report states that there was no recognizable pattern.
So whatever it is, I don't know what the right of way. And of course, we have all kinds of right of ways. You have the utility right of way where they put big utility poles up.
Correct.
Or electricity, for example. That's mm-hmm. a permanent fixture, and it's in the way, and you can't build under it. And that's a bit more severe encumbrance. Whereas the buried pipeline, I assume, has some lesser impact, but some impact. And your expert put it at 25%, is that what
I believe that's correct, yes.
And that was based on these other comparables and recognition,
right,
that there's a difference.
There is
before
now
and after.
There a pipeline.
Fair market value before and after.
And based on an assumption of not just continued agricultural use, but some potential for development?
He, in his arriving at his value per acre, he did say that there was some recognized that at some point in the future it might possibly be used. So he did increase the per price per acre, recognizing that it was, it could be, it's adaptable to future uses. It wasn't foreseeable that there would be. There wasn't anything that would lead to that being the highest and best use.
Did he attach a figure to that?
I'm pardon?
Did he attach a figure to that?
I I don't know that he attached
a... He just said there might be in the future, but we don't know what it would be.
So he increased the value per acre from what certain value of farmland, and he raised it to a little over $10,000 an acre. So there was a dollar increase per acre based
How
on the...
How much dollar increase per
acre? I don't know as I stand here, Judge. I apologize.
And what did he predicate that on?
He predicated that on that there was the land was adaptable.
I understand, but where do you get the number?
Just based on his experience as an appraiser and selling properties. Yeah, judgment.
He guessed. He had no comparables, so he just
his
guessed.
His comparables were derived at the agricultural value, and his highest and best use is agricultural.
Well, if one expert is excluded because he doesn't have sufficient predicate for his opinion, why isn't the other?
Well, our expert was not challenged. It's not up on appeal, and it's not for the decision
today. I was just curious.
Had that issue been raised, we could...
Using his gatekeeper's program, and he kept one expert out and not the other.
I would say that he has the support in his appraisal to back up that opinion. I don't have it on the top of my head.
I was asking what the support was.
And I don't know. I'm sure it's in his report. I know he exercises judgment.
Someplace along the line, you think there might be a real meritorious presumption in his part. Something that led to his presumption to make it valid.
Yes.
But you don't know what it is.
I do not. Not before the court today. I'm not prepared to address it. I apologize. I do think the issue that is here today is it's a Rule 702 issue with regard to the exclusion of Mr. Stollard's opinion.
I know what the issue is.
Okay, and then I think that the summary judgment then also then falls as there was no admissible evidence as to the value to the remainder, which is the owner's burden to carry in a condemnation case on their counterclaim. I would point out that...
Can I take it, have they been paid yet the amount that the court did ascertain?
The money has been deposited. It has not been paid to them.
It's paid into court, right? And is it?
Well, it is not paid into court. It's paid into escrow by agreement of the parties and the abundance of precaution
somewhere.
That they not waive any of their appellate rights. We've got the checks were issued and it's escrowed.
It's in escrow. Okay.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Anything further?
May it please the court. Returning to a discussion or a rebuttal as to what evidence might have existed regarding that would help create an enhancement of this property and show its potential. One of the largest debates in this entire foray, if you read the depositions of the expert witnesses, were the amount of utilities that were available on the land in question. The land that sits next to, immediately adjacent to Glen Arm has essentially every utility, including water, that would be necessary for the development of that property. The expert opinion, the land engineer, opined that it's a simple matter to bring that water under the interstate, just like it was a simple matter to bring a pipeline under
Which
the interstate.
Which expert? The one that was excluded or the one that didn't?
No, the donors, unspoken of in the opinion, retained land engineer to opine as to certain issues regarding development, including the difficulty of developing around a pipeline placement. And the court doesn't talk about that. The court doesn't talk about the fact that their own that Rocky's expert acknowledged an enhancement of value based upon its potential development, nor do they talk about the fact that their land engineer recognized the potential of development on 3 out of 4 of these tracts that are in question.
Based on the adjacent utility access?
Based upon availability of what utilities were there, based upon what utilities could readily be brought. The only utility that was shown that wasn't there is a sewer, and that's shown to be within a mile to 2 miles on either side coming toward this particular plot of land.
That's a long way. What municipality would extend those utilities?
Glen Arm. Glen Arm is an unincorporated subdivision that is, in effect, a town that sits there.
Well, does this require an annexation, for example?
No, not necessarily.
They're going to extend water and sewer.
And we did, and that was a prime...
But who pays for that extension?
Well, certainly the owners would.
Yeah.
But that doesn't, that the opinion wasn't as if it had been subdivided and plotted with sidewalks. The opinion was only, no, it's ready for and suitable for development, and this is the price that it would bring in a sale in this expert's opinion. We didn't draw ourselves into a circle of saying, we're going to put 452 houses in here with this kind of stuff, and it would cost this much to do it.
You didn't value it by the square foot, I understand.
We did not. And when you look at the adjustments that our expert made, we think that it's understandable that some of those were $6.52 a foot. He marked ours down to 50 cents a foot. He was taking into consideration the fact that, look, the fact that it had been severely reduced because it didn't have the curbs, the gutters, and it was a larger parcel of land.
Sure.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. Take the case under advisement.